The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Bankrupt orchestras, aging audiences, declining attendance, skyrocketing conservatory tuition. Classical music in America is in peril. So who's to blame? The record industry, the internet, pop musicians? Will Roselip has a different idea. He wants to take down classical music's traditional culture. In his book, The Libertine's Guide to the Classical Music Revolution, he outlines why the industry is in crisis and some ideas on how to save it. Will Roselip is a cellist, a media director for the Cambridge Philharmonic, and author of the Classical Dark Arts blog. And Will, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia. Good to be here.
So who did you write this book for? Is it for musicians?
The reason I wrote the book in the first place is because I'd seen, you know, a billion Slate articles about the death of classical music, and I was just getting a little tired of that. I mean, every few months we sort of revisit the topic, and from where I stand, it's very much alive. It's just sort of in a little, we'll call it a recession or a little dip in interest. And it seemed like we need a fresh reboot, just a new pair of eyes to look at things, and I'm not saying that I'm that pair of eyes. But it's sort of common sense that we need to not necessarily reboot it, but we do need to represent it to people and present it in a way that makes sense. Like what a line I use in the book and that I've repeated ad infinitum after that is that classical music doesn't have a seat at the pop culture table. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem because we forget that like people have very short attention spans. And it's really hard to market classical music in that small amount of time. But I think we have to figure out a way not to dumb it down, but just to break off a little piece for people so they can figure out how they get into it.
Well, classical music always has had a reputation for being stuffy or inaccessible, not really having a seat at the pop music table. Is part of the problem the culture of performances themselves, which I think for a lot of people feels prohibitive?
I think so. I think it's a little stuffy. It's been a little too formal for a long time. I was at a concert recently. And I won't say the orchestra, but it was a big orchestra. And as the performer was coming out on stage, I pulled out my phone to take a little video of it. And I felt like I was a pariah or something for just taking 30 seconds of video to show people what it was like mm-hmm. when this particular performer came out on stage. I'm like, oh. So that's something we really need to work on. I think that making it more comfortable for audiences, everything from like not dressing, we look like penguins up on stage. We've got all the tuxedos and the formal wear, dressed for a funeral or something. I don't know who decided on this dress code, but I think we can just get rid of it. And also, you know, when you look out into the audiences, you have a certain level of dress or decorum or whatever, and people are just kind of scared. They're scared to make noise. You hear a few coughs in between movements, but other than that, you don't really get a lot from the audience except for the obligatory bravos at the end. It would be nice to change that. When Mozart performed some of his new pieces, he wrote a letter, I think, to one of his family members saying, you know, I premiered one of my works and the audience was so loud I had to go back and play it two or three or four more times because they were so into that. That's like the most foreign experience now, and it's kind of a shame. I mean, we really need to do something about it.
Well, so you're a millennial, you're a cellist. What's going to work then? What will make these orchestral performances and the music a little more accessible?
Well, I don't think it's any one thing necessarily. I can just say anecdotally, when I've performed for a bunch of different things. You know, I've played at weddings and funerals. I've done performances at sort of business organizations and that kind of stuff, on down through orchestral shows and in bars. And the thing that really resonates with people is that you can kind of approach the performers. If you do it in less stuffy settings, like you get into art galleries or you play outdoors or it's like street musicians, whatever, like people feel much more comfortable to just come up, take in the music and just, you know, decide how much they want to engage. The problem is, you know, oftentimes we get them into symphony halls and we just close and lock the doors and like, nope, you're not moving for an hour and a half. And if you do, then you've just broken protocol. You'll be banished for life. And one of the groups that I talk about a lot is Group Muse, which is this new thing in Boston. I think it's in New York now, too, where it stages shows in people's living rooms. And this is kind of a genius idea because everybody's just kind of sitting around. They're having snacks. They're drinking a beer. And in between pieces, the performer talks to the audience like a normal human being, not like some alien up on stage, describes the piece, why she likes playing this piece, etc. So it's a really interesting concept, and I think one that more orchestras and more performers would do well to emulate.
You also advocate for smaller orchestras, slimmed down school curricula, reasonable expectations for audience interest. But let's look at this, Will. I mean, symphony orchestras are definitely in trouble. In 2011, the Philadelphia Orchestra declared bankruptcy. There have been strikes and lockouts in Minnesota, Atlanta. It suggests that something is really wrong. So what do you do with these kind of big structural problems? You're talking about, you know, kind of rebuilding a whole ecosystem here.
Yeah, it's kind of daunting. I don't necessarily have the answer to this question, but I will say in the book that I was advocating for smaller groups, sort of a more of a startup mentality where you just do as bare bones as possible in order to generate interest, to generate a set of core fans, you know, the diehards who are going to come to every show. Mm-hmm. They retweet every tweet that your orchestra sends out. They like everything on Facebook. That kind of approach may help. I think when you're talking about bigger orchestras, it's a little bit more of a conundrum. I think that adventurousness in programming is one great area to start, not necessarily always programming in a way where, you know, you do your overture to start off with, then you do the concerto, then you take a nice little respite, a little intermission, then come back and you do the big symphony or whatever. Like, you know, there's some room to experiment in there. And I think people will really respect orchestras, not only that don't pander to the same kinds of things that have always worked, but who have their audience in mind and want to try something new. And I think they'll respond if they see that the orchestra is taking some risks. Mm-hmm. They'll be like, oh, wow, you know.
When you're talking, I was thinking smaller orchestras, smaller performance halls, kind of limits the repertoire. But is that the point, to get off of the kind of greatest hits bandwagon, I guess, you know, play new composers?
That would be nice, yeah. And you see a lot of new composers write for really unusual ensembles and a lot of smaller stuff. The full orchestra is always will be the sort of Dolby 5.1 surround sound experience. It is the 24-karat experience for classical music. There won't ever be a replacement for that. I mean, when we look at big occasions, you know, heads of state who pass away for the Olympics, whatever, you see tremendously large orchestras, and there's a reason for that because it's a lot of sound, and it's fascinating to watch players like that. But it's not the only way that you can present classical music. There are many other ways. And there's nothing stopping an orchestra, like here we have the Boston Symphony. There's nothing stopping the Boston Symphony from also doing breakout shows, from doing shows off campus, hopefully, you know, in communities of color, reaching out to people who don't normally go to classical shows. You don't have to have the full symphony on stage every night of the week.
But does the audience really want to hear new composers? I mean, looking at classical music sales and what's popular, it looks like a lot of retread.
There are some people who just like to go and hear the hits, and I totally get that. I love the hits. I love Beethoven above almost all other composers. But at the same time, I think they're willing to go along for the ride. You look at a composer like John Luther Adams. He has a new piece out called Become Ocean, which was recorded by the Seattle Symphony. And this, I mean, this is a really fascinating piece. You know, he probably wrote it last year or 2013 or something like that. And you can tell by reviews of the orchestra's playing, by reviews of the CD, that he's really taking some risks, but also, like, connecting with some of the core stuff, like the moments of big feeling that the audience wants to hear still. So that's, I mean, there's promise in moments and in composers and pieces like that. We have to be driving towards that. But yeah, it's a fine balance between the classics and some of the newer stuff.
Let's pause and hear a little bit of John Luther Adams' composition, Become Ocean. Well, it seems we've been hearing that classical music is dead for a long time. Will Roslip begs to differ. He says we have to find new ways to play, perform, and experience classical music. His new book is called The Libertine's Guide to the Classical Music Revolution. Classical music tastes are also shaped by what we hear on classical music radio. So what role do stations play in this, and what changes would you like to hear?
I would like to hear more stations, more classical DJs or whatever you want to call them, be like Funkmaster Flex. I said this in the book where he's sitting in.
Let's just clarify. He's on Hot 97. That's a New York station, hip hop station.
Yes. Yeah. Hip hop DJ. And he's been doing it for years and years. And the fascinating thing about him is that he's not just lining up a playlist. It's not like, you know, just turning on Spotify and walking away for 3 hours. He's toying with listeners. He's playing pieces for them. He's giving them little snippets. If he's got a premiere, like a new Beyonce track, he's not going to give you the whole thing. He's just going to give you like 15 seconds of the beat and stop. And he'll play the little record scratch thing, you know, and then stop everything dead in its tracks and be like, yeah, it's great. But if you want to hear the whole thing, you got to come back later. And just keep doing that and just tantalizes the audience and it's genius. I'd like to hear more of that. I know that some stations are heading more towards a movement by movement performance rather than playing complete works. I'm of two minds on that because it's nice to be able to carve up things the way you want to carve them up. But on the other side, you do want to, you know, it is good to hear stuff in its entirety, the way the composer wrote it. But I think any composer would just be relieved that we're playing her or his music today, you know, maybe 100 or 200 years after the piece was written.
Okay, so we've covered the role of the audience, the performances, the compositions, the playing on radio stations and presentation. You also target the marketing of classical music. Now, if you had control over marketing classical music, what would you do?
Yeah, in terms of the marketing, I think that we would really want to look more at things like the way mixtapes are marketed to people. So mixtapes are basically uploaded by an artist online and then just sent out to any fans who want to consume that. Right now, there's sort of a gatekeeper approach with some of the record labels. Mm-hmm. And they start with the artist. They repack some favorites. They add some, you know, high art or artwork to the project and then just send it off for people to enjoy and digest and whatever. It's not so much the way that music is consumed anymore. It's an immediate thing. You know, it's a reactionary thing. When there's all the stuff that happened in Ferguson, you saw many artists responding by putting out songs about Ferguson.
Right.
And I think that classical music could be very much the same. It can be in the moment. It can talk to people in the same way that you would talk about any other kind of music, whether it's hip hop, electronica, metal, whatever, but without insulting anybody or just seeming kind of like a little out of the conversational loop.
Right. Well, the music industry has changed dramatically for everybody, especially those in the middle ground, not those on top of the food chain. I mean, Katy Perry and Taylor Swift and Pharrell are still doing just fine. But everyone's trying to figure out this new model. Can it be applied to classical music?
Yeah, the Katy Perrys of the world, the Taylor Swifts, whoever, are always going to be playing the Super Bowl halftime show. There's no way around that because people like a show and you have to have somebody to slot in there. But on down the line from them, basically we've got smaller, more independent artists who may or may not have a label affiliation, who are doing their own sort of marketing. And this goes back to the core set of fans, the ones who really like your work, who are almost going to be doing some of your marketing for you. They feel passionate enough about this new release that they're just going to jump all over it. There's a rapper named Joey Bad who's out of New York City, and I know he has a release in a week or 2 weeks. And I'm tweeting this out to all my friends and messaging them, like, you have to hear this when it comes out. And that's the sort of model or approach that I think classical music has to go to as well. You know, you have people on a mailing list or whatever, and they say, and you just talk to them and say, we could really use some help with this. If you want to tell your friends about it, you know, here's all the information you're going to need to promote this. And it's not a guaranteed thing. Unfortunately, the days of making the most money off of album sales are probably over. But you can still do well on merch. You can still do well on ticket sales, on getting people to come out and support Kickstarter, things like that. So I think it's a combination of those things that are going to be the answer. There's not one silver bullet at this time.
Well, I feel like we've had a little bit of a pep talk. Will, thank you.
I'm glad you feel that way. Thanks, Virginia. It was fun.
Will Roslip is a cellist. He's also media director for the Cambridge Philharmonic and a producer at WGBH Radio. There's a link to look at his new book. There's a link to his new book, The Libertine's Guide to the Classical Music Revolution, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we would love to hear from you. Is classical music dead? Do you listen to it? Do your kids listen to it? Do you shell out money to buy CDs or attend performances? You can join in the discussion on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Up next, the long and storied history of music at sea. Did the Titanic's orchestra really play a hymn as the ship went down? We'll find out when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Countless legends and myths surround the sinking of the Titanic. Among them, the story of how the in-house musicians sank with the ship. They were not, as many think, playing a hymn, but those doomed musicians were part of a long and rich history of musical entertainment on board ocean liners. From the earliest passenger steamers to the lavish Queen Mary II, music at sea has always been considered a necessary luxury. Amber Edwards brings us the story.
So, you're one of the lucky ones who can pay between $2,000 and $50,000 for a 6-day crossing on the new QM2. You've donned your tux or ball gown, and as you sweep into the ballroom, this is what you'll probably hear.
There's probably a top 10, which that's high up there in the top 3 of the classics.
Martin Lilly is entertainment director for the Cunard line.
Both the Queen Elizabeth II and the Queen Mary II have a very large ballroom, the Queen's Room. It's a signature feature on both of the ships. We have gentlemen dance hosts there to dance with the single ladies that travel with us, because we have a lot of single ladies that travel. And in those rooms, we have a dedicated dance band to play the standards, the classics, so people can relive some of the golden years.
They know that they're dealing largely with old, retired people, so they have to please them.
John Maxton Graham is a maritime historian who spends most of his time writing and lecturing aboard passenger ships.
They are desperate to attract younger people. All the cruise lines want to get bronzed, slim, cleft-chinned, beautiful people in their 30s and 40s who will come on board and sort of give the place an elegant tone.
Love.
Like on the Love Boat?
Exciting and new.
Love Boat is a grotesquely inaccurate program. It had nothing to do with real shipboard. It was tailored for television audience. But it did serve to popularize cruising.
In other words, the captain is unlikely to personally greet you as you embark. However, there probably will be a disco somewhere on board, even on the ultra-posh QM2.
We have a disco on Queen Mary II.
Again, Cunard's Martin Lilly.
And they're still popular, depending on what time of year, of course, and your demographic, but there are discos.
So this is a terrible battle the cruise lines face. They have to provide all the basics. They have to provide In the Mood and Glenn Miller and all the World War II stuff. But at the same time, they want to be perceived as hip and have the discotheque and the latest stuff, just the way they did in the 20s.
It was in the 20s, says Maxton Graham, that mass transatlantic tourism really took off.
Because in 1920, Congress lowered the boom. No more immigrants. They had these huge ships with no immigrant passengers allowed. So they just reversed the flow and they booked Americans, cheap passage to Europe. And those Americans had the latest music at home, and the shipping companies were mainly European. So what they did was they went around to undergraduate college bands and they hired undergraduates in June to come on board, make an eastbound crossing, playing for the passengers every night. And then they would spend 2 months in a casino in France or in Germany playing again for Europeans who were intrigued with this new music, and then they'd sail back and do another gig for their westbound passage, singing for their supper, in effect. And it was really a wonderful infusion of American music going across to Europe.
In the earliest days of transatlantic travel, there was no musical entertainment at all, just hymns during the Sunday morning worship service. Then, as ships got bigger and more comfortable in the late 19th century, with electric lights, refrigeration, and formal dining, passenger expectations rose accordingly. So a steward who was handy with a fiddle or clarinet would be pressed into service as entertainment.
And they played for the passengers after dinner when they'd finished their job, and they were either bedroom stewards or dining room stewards, and they got tipped for their work. So it was a way that the company could provide entertainment, but not, it didn't cost them anything. They didn't have to ship musicians in.
Of course, the most famous shipboard musicians of all were the ones who perished with the Titanic, playing as she sank.
The Titanic musicians were professional musicians hired from shore. They were carried as second-class passengers.
And contrary to the myth, they were not playing Nearer My God to Thee, but a popular waltz of the time.
And it was a famous waltz, been written by an Englishman called Archibald Joyce. And it was a great hit in London and a great hit in New York in 1912. And one of the radio operators of the Titanic when he was coming ashore off the Carpathia in New York, the ship that brought in all the survivors, the reporter said, "What was the tune? What was the last tune they played?" And he said, "They played Autumn," which was his shorthand way of dealing with a French title, which is Songe d'Automne, which means dreams or thoughts of autumn.
The eight Titanic musicians were usually split into a string quintet and a piano trio.
But on that night, the night of the 14th of April, 1912, all eight played together, which meant that one pianist dropped out because they didn't need two pianists. So there was a piano septet playing in the lounge. Then they were found later, from witnesses, wearing their life jackets and overcoats, standing at the top of the main staircase, where there was also a piano. And then they went outdoors to play, out on the boat deck, in the dark, with no music stands, with no lights, and severe cold is very tough on catgut, it's very hard to tune their instruments. They had to play things they knew well, because they couldn't see, they had no music.
Maybe if you listen hard, a modern voyager might still be able to make out the strains of autumn floating over the Atlantic as they did so bravely that cold spring night long ago. I'm Amber Edwards.
We've heard this before, right? When discontent is high, out come the comparisons between the perilous state of the American Republic and the fall of ancient Rome. Up next, we'll unearth an unexpected parallel between the two powers, over-reliance on one condiment. We'll pour it on when Word of Mouth continues after a break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among the theories of why Rome fell, we can now add fish sauce. Well, if not the cause, the overuse of fish sauce was at least symbolic of the decadence of the ancient Romans. In a post called Caveat Condimentor, our next guest notes some disturbing parallels between America's growing obsession with sriracha and the condiment monoculture of the ancient world. Tom Nealon collects and sells and writes about rare cookbooks and writes a series called Stuffed for High-Low Brow. Tom Nealon, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Ah, thanks very much.
So how popular was fish sauce in ancient Rome?
I mean, it was more popular than ketchup is now. I mean, probably more popular than anything we can imagine.
So it went in on everything?
Almost. By the end, the only existing cookbook from ancient Rome that we have is called Apicius, and it's in almost every recipe.
So how was it made, this fish sauce?
There were a couple different kinds, I think, based on quality and what it was made from, whether it was mackerel guts or actual fish. But it was basically steeped in salt so that it just liquefied the fish. Very similar to Thai fish sauce now or something like that. But it would just, they'd sit it out in the sun.
Ooh, that sounds pretty stinky.
It was. That's why they had to move the factories outside of cities because people complained so much.
Well, there was a considerable amount of energy and the economy devoted to producing fish sauce. You found evidence of the recipe for fish sauce becoming less pure as its popularity grew. What was going into fish sauce?
Almost everything. Cockles, you know, mussels, almost any sea creature you can imagine. You know, eels, you know, just the fins of eels. Everything that, from the, according to Pliny at least, everything from the ocean that you could imagine fishing out of there, they would melt down with salt and turn into fish sauce.
So is this a sign of something much deeper, Tom Nealon?
I think it was. I think it was a sign of the decadence, of the extremes that they'd gone to, where, you know, everyone was a Roman citizen, so everyone had this right to fish sauce, so they just turned everything into fish sauce.
So it mirrored the decline of the empire, as you write. You've discovered a parallel in America's burgeoning condiment monoculture, which I would have think would be ketchup, but no.
It's not. You know, ketchup never really got, because Heinz standardized it, and there's only really one way to make ketchup. People have tried with some of those green ketchup, but nothing else ever caught on. So it was never this, put it on everything unless you're a 5-year-old. But sriracha, now is seems to be going in that direction.
Well, this is the Sriracha is in a bright red bottle with a green top and a rooster, also been called hipster ketchup. What are some of the parallels between Rome's fish sauce and today's Sriracha?
Well, you have the counterfeits of this, and now everyone's making it. I just ran into Badia now makes a Sriracha. Everybody's making Sriracha, and you can turn anything into it. If you go to DIY Sriracha on Google, you'll find all sorts of horrifying ideas about things you could make out of.
So they're watering down Sriracha in the same way that it happened with fish sauce in Rome.
And it's going to go offshore, just so you know. It used to be, at least we made it out in California, although, you know, just like the fish sauce factories, they had to move one of the Sriracha factories because people were complaining about the stench and the burning of eyes and that you get from all those chilies being pureed.
Well, is there an upside, though? I mean, it's the ubiquity of Sriracha does suggest that we're getting away from the bland, waspy food traditions of America in the 20th century, anyway.
No question. In the middle of the century was a real dead spot for condiments and for culture. That's where ranch dressing came from, the blandness of the middle of the 20th century.
Well, you know, it's a rare that we get to speak to a condiment historian. So can you settle for me the difference between catsup, the C-A-T-S-U-P, and ketchup?
I tend to say catsup, C-A-T-S-U-P. They're both transliterations of approximations of a Chinese word. So really neither of them's right. But catsup is what I tend to call the whole range of them. Before there was just tomato ketchup, there was walnut and cockle ketchup, and oyster ketchup, and mushroom ketchup. So I tend to call those catsup.
Cockles as in cockles and mussels, alive,
yep,
alive-o.
Yep, exactly.
So, Tom, I mean, if you're looking at condiments as some sort of bellwether of our culture, where are we going?
So that's a good question, you know. But I would say it doesn't look good. I think there's too much sriracha out there, and it's weeding out all the hot sauces. Sriracha's great, but it's a puree. Really not the same thing. It doesn't have the same vinegary bite. And you have all these counterfeits, just like you did with the fish sauce, you know, fake srirachas with wrong colored caps and dragons instead of roosters. And just like you did when you would farm it out and you'd have, you know, counterfeit Spanish fish sauce and, you know, Sardinian fish sauce when they'd farmed these factories out of Rome. So I would say it's something to be watched.
Tom Nealon, he collects and sells and writes about rare cookbooks. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Tom's series is called Stuffed, that he writes for High Lowbrow, and you can find a link to that as well as his extremely popular De Condimentis series with topics from gravy bastardization to balsamic lies, among others. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Many people would be repulsed by sauce made from fermented fish entrails. Sometimes it's just the idea of a food source that makes us squeamish, completely apart from the taste. Consider roadkill. If you eat meat, is there anything wrong with butchering and cooking a freshly killed animal, even if it's been slayed by a Buick? Last spring, Montana passed a law allowing people to pick up dead animals on the side of the road and eat them. Producer Madeline Beck brings us the story.
How do you like it, Cook?
Okay, two quick things to know about me before I go any further. One, I'm a vegetarian. Two, I used to hunt, but when I gave it up to go to college, I also gave up eating meat.
Well, that's really red on the inside. Look at that.
I've only broken my vegetarianism two times in the past 3 years. First time was to try some extremely fresh salmon up in Alaska while working at a fish processing plant. Second time was when I ate freshly cooked clams at a clam bar up in Rhode Island that was apparently a favorite of Drew Barrymore. And now I'll break it again, this time for roadkill.
There's really no difference. Once a deer is dead, it's dead. It had obviously just happened. I've hunted for 40 years and killed a lot of deer, and so I kind of know that one felt really warm, smelled good. Then it had died from the car hitting it and just massive trauma. There was very little blood on the highway. Well, there was some blood on the highway, but not much.
I'd love to introduce you to this Montanan who's going to cook me up some roadkill, but he won't allow me to tell you his name on air.
My wife
thinks it's abhorrent that I pick up roadkill and doesn't want anybody to know that I have roadkill deer.
Can we refer to you as any nickname?
Preferably not even that. Old Hunter.
Well, Old Hunter is one of many people in Montana to use a relatively new law. It allows people to download a permit and legally pick up roadkill for whatever purposes suit them. Ron Ozheim is a spokesman for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, which has been running the program out of its Bozeman office since November. Ozheim and FWP are keeping close track on how many are taking advantage of the law.
I assume we're in the 290s probably by now. I'm surprised, I think we're surprised, that there are that many applicants for the permit. Obviously, 290 people are enjoying the new law.
The way it works is, say you hit an animal or come across one someone else hit. First step, pick it up and take it away, leaving no scraps behind. Step two, go home and take care of it, disposing what you don't want in your own garbage or in a non-public area. Step three, within 24 hours, go onto the FWP's website. Search for roadkill licenses and fill out where, when, what, and in what manner you picked up your roadkill. And step five, print it out.
Oh, it's extremely simple. You just go online and you don't even talk to anybody. You just fill out the form. And it was actually really simple and really easy and fairly quick and painless. And then I printed it up so that I had a piece of paper to put with the meat, because legally you're supposed to keep your tag with the meat in your freezer.
Now Old Hunter's roadkill is out of the freezer.
This was a whitetail that I ran into. This is backstrap. Oh yeah, this looks nice.
We're in a cozy house in East Missoula. The kitchen is fairly small and narrow, but clean and organized, with just a bare essentials hanging out on the granite countertop. It flows directly into the living room and dining room with wood paneling and dark, thick rugs. He lives here with his wife. His two kids are grown and gone. Since his wife and kids don't like the taste of deer, the meat he salvages lasts quite a while, even when he shares it with friends. Old Hunter looks the part of someone who might eat roadkill. He's cooking it up in a gray thermal shirt under a jean jacket with thick plaid lining. He's a rugged type. Sarah, another roadkill eater, is not. Or at least appears less so in her puffy pink coat and bright green backpack.
I think the permit system is a really excellent thing. Because, I mean, those poor people whose job is to go pick up roadkill, like, that's disgusting. And if it's a source of free food, hell yeah.
Okay, so this isn't really Sarah. She won't let me tell you her name because her roadkill story involves breaking the law. Before the new law passed, she and a few other college students were out looking for roadkill. They use it as bait in biological experiments involving attracting predators.
We were driving east of Missoula, headed east, and I can't give a whole ton of details, but we were searching for roadkill, and there was this yearling deer on the side of the road that was pretty freshly hit.
How did you know it was freshly hit?
The person I was with could tell. They have seen a lot of roadkill in their day.
Just hours later, they ate it.
It tasted a lot more mild than other venison that I've had. And it was also, like, almost buttery because it was so young and soft and tender. It was kind of like, I don't know, I guess kind of like veal. A couple guys just cut out the back straps and we fried it up with some, I think some olive oil and some vegetables, and there were a couple hairs in it, which was kind of weird, but it was fine.
Old Hunter's roadkill is older, less hairy. It's been cut up, packaged, frozen, and thawed, and now he's frying it up with some Sweet Baby Ray's. Looks edible, but his description makes me a little uneasy.
Well, it looks redder. You can see it looks redder. There's more blood in the meat, but it's not dripping off in blood or anything.
He's about to set some on my plate when he realizes it's not quite finished. As he puts it back on the pan, he talks about his take on the permits. They're important, he says, especially now.
Hunting has really changed in the last 10 years tremendously, any hunter will tell you. It's kind of a complicated picture. The wolves are, they're fairly smart to start out. And they're pretty well driven back to the deepest, highest, most remote places due to the hunting and trapping. They're not dumb. They're going to, you know, they've been shot at. The problem is these wolves drive the elk and the deer out of the backcountry, and that's typically where we hunt them. Hunters for 100 years in Montana, you go to the backwoods and you hunt for elk. Well, now the further back you go, the less you find. So where do they go? They go to where they're safe, which is down on ranches land.
and hunters can't get to them without permission. Old hunters' take is that ranchers have their reasons for keeping hunters out. Some won't let people onto their land because they're out-of-staters who would rather pay for and feed the animals, or they just don't trust hunters in general. Though large elk herds destroy fences and eat crops, they may be less of a danger than a hunter's poorly aimed shot. For some, the elk may even mean protection.
One hunter got up at this meeting and he said he talked to a rancher. The rancher said he could not hunt on his ranch. And he stopped to ask him why. And the rancher said this. He says, well, the wolves are up at the top in the high country. The elk are in the middle. And all my cattle are down here in the bottom land. Why would I let you go hunting and move those elk? Those elk are protecting my cattle.
Declining numbers of deer add to the complications. There are fewer of them because of predators, including wolves, and diseases like blue tongue. Regulators want to limit the number of doe licenses for the state for the next two seasons, which means an even tougher hunt. Suddenly, I'm feeling a bit luckier that my host would offer to share his meat. So I dig in.
You can have some barbecue sauce there or anything you want. I got Worcestershire.
It tastes pretty much exactly like the deer I'd hunted with my dad back in high school. Pretty darn good.
I think it's an excellent thing. A lot of that roadkill goes to waste. And, I mean, they try to save as much as they can. And I think it's a much better idea to try to get us to as hunters that can use it for people. If it's still good, it's still good. It's really no different than going out and shooting an animal. I don't understand why anybody would oppose it. You're using good meat for human consumption. It makes perfect sense.
Reporting from Missoula, Montana, I'm Madeline Beck.
And from roadkill, we move to live eels, raw owl's eggs, and pickled sheep's eye. A tour of history's craziest hangover cures when word of mouth returns.
Hangover, 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 hangover,
word
hangover,
mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
Hangover. Try to make a back of memory over and over. Hangover, hangover, hangover.
A banana, a big glass of water, and two Tylenol. Or maybe a Bloody Mary with plenty of horseradish and a greasy breakfast. Others swear by copious amounts of black coffee and an ice-cold shower. Hangover cures are pretty much as plentiful as the drinks that caused them in the first place. If you've ever over-imbibed, you've likely suffered the consequences: pounding headache, dry mouth, and an increased sensitivity to light or sound. The history of hangover cures is equal parts interesting and disgusting, and joining us to discuss a few old favorites, along with some new high-tech options, is Justin Jones, reporter for the Daily Beast. He compiled a list of history's craziest hangover cures. Justin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So the excesses of the holidays are behind us, so we're kind of out of hangover triage when we can rationally study up on cures. Among the most enduring, cabbage used since ancient times. What's the reason for that?
It just really seems that cabbage, it contains certain chemicals that helps neutralize the alcohol's effects on the liver during the metabolizing process. So it's kind of one of those things that they would go to, like we go to eggs now or heavy fat foods to kind of soak up, and they thought would help with the hangover cures.
So this is since the Greeks, the Romans, and ancient Egyptians used this. They still do?
Yep. It seems to be something that's carried over into today. You know, it's even been suggested, you know, from beauty magazines and things to help cure a headache or something as simple as that.
Cabbage doesn't sound so bad, but how about raw owl's eggs, another traditional cure?
Yeah, and that's really not too far off from, like I said, what we do today. I mean, it's very easy to get up in the morning after a night of drinking and immediately go towards eggs and coffee as something to kind of help you push on through the rest of the day.
Well, what do you think you're craving when you're going for a raw owl's egg?
I am not sure. I personally would not try to take in a raw egg, but that's just my personal taste. I don't think I could stand the consistency.
Pickled sheep's eyes, fried canary, a couple of other cures from the ancients. How about from the Middle Ages? What kind of cures did you find popular then?
For the Middle Ages, it seemed to be predominantly raw eel.
Raw eel?
Raw eel, yeah. Which, you know, sushi is not the first thing you think of when you want to wake up in the morning after you've been drinking, and especially when you're a little bit nauseous. But, it contains a lot of protein and calcium and vitamins, and much more so than eggs. So it's really just a healthy option to kind of boost all of your entire system.
And what did the ancients think? You know, they weren't thinking about calcium and nutrients.
I guess the myth of the time was that the eel would come alive and kind of drink up all the alcohol in your stomach, which is a little crazy.
When did people start creating these kind of concoctions to cure the effects of too much drink?
Well, it came about, you know, as early as the 1600s, and that's really when a lot of people working with herbs and kind of homeopathic remedies were mixing things together. And then, you know, once the Victorian ages hit, they would have like peppermint water, prairie oyster, and a prairie oyster is essentially kind of like a Bloody Mary. So it was raw egg yolk, again, the egg for the protein, and Worcestershire sauce, Tabasco sauce, vinegar, salt, and pepper. So, you know, some of these things we still use today.
Sounds better than a powder made from the skull of a person hanged and a dried viper, which was another one you discovered from the 1600s.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure how readily available skulls were were then, but I guess everyone had one on hand.
Well, some of these sound really crazy, but they make sense. You found, you know, if you look at them chemically, like soot, which was popular among Victorians. What does it do for the body?
Yeah, so soot, which is, you know, the remnants left over from the burned wood and fireplaces, it acts a lot like charcoal would. So, you know, in charcoal, it rebalances the acid alkaline of the digestive system. So they would mix it with milk, and it's really no different from any over-the-counter antacids that you would find today.
So interesting, but I'm sort of trying to imagine the process of discovering that.
Right.
And then, of course, there were the drugs. What are some of the drugs that have been used through the ages to help cure the hangover?
Yeah, so, you know, the first aspirin tablet was introduced in, I think, the early 1900s, Alka-Seltzer shortly after. And just like coffee, you know, stimulants were also used. So Coca-Cola at one point had cocaine in it. And, you know, that was used, I think, in... when was it? In 1938, they started mixing Coke and milk. Not sure the reasoning behind that either, but as bartenders do, they mix together, you know, concoctions for their patrons that come in the next day with a really bad hangover. So that was one of them used.
Seems like current cures are a lot less painful than, you know, I don't know, dried viper. What are some of the more recent remedies for hangovers?
Yeah, so it seems like the most recent one that's kind of come to the market is Bitox, which is a patch. So it works a lot like a nicotine patch. You put it on your body before you go out drinking or, you know, when you think you're going to be taking in a lot of alcohol. So you put on the patch, and it just basically floods your body with a lot of vitamins and minerals. So you have a constant stream coming through you throughout the entire time that you're drinking. Mercy is another one, which is a canned drink, and it acts the same way, but you can use it as a mixer. You can drink it before, which most of them suggest you do is drink it before, and also drink it the next day when you wake up. But the one that seems to be the most effective, at least time-wise, it's very fast-acting, is the IV doctor, and it's essentially a doctor service that you can order up on your phone through the website, and they will come to your work, they'll come to your home, and pump you with IV with a bag of nutrients for an hour, and you're good to go after that. And we've actually tested that here in the office, and the three people that used the service actually said that it worked really, really well.
Even an hour? Just an hour?
Just an hour.
I've heard that they have actually buses or vans that travel around in Las Vegas with the IV doc cure.
Oh, wow. So is that just kind of an on-the-spot?
Yeah, I guess so. They'll drive on over to your house and fill you full of, what, a banana bag?
Yeah, that's essentially what the IV doc does.
So, Justin, care to share your own? Were you one of those who tested this IV doc?
Unfortunately, I was not. I would have loved to experience it firsthand, but I wasn't. Mine, I mean, my kind of go-to hangover cure for myself would be, you know, I try to eat a big breakfast in the morning. Of course, drink a large glass of water before you go to bed, some ibuprofen. But, you know, I don't think there ever will be a solid hangover cure. I think we're always going to have to deal with our repercussions.
Well, Justin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Justin Jones, a reporter for the Daily Beast. You can find a link to read his article, History's Craziest Hangover Cures, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for listening today. There is plenty more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org or in the NHPR app. Earlier in the show, cellist and music writer Will Roselip offered some tough love for the classical music world. And we'd like to hear from you on this matter. Is classical music dead? It's had a pretty good run. Is it our responsibility to keep it on life support or let it fade out to its natural evolution? Do you listen to it? Do your kids listen to it? Do you shell out money to buy CDs or attend performances? You can join the discussion on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.